Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Advise Show Radio, the station that brings you intense discussions about the hottest topics. Make sure you join us by calling in at 347-996-3350. Now, here are your hosts, Gabriella and the Advise Show.
What's going on, everyone? Thank you for joining the show on this Monday night. Tonight's topic is feminism and white privilege. Now, the reason why we decided to go that route, for a long while, I wanted to do a show on feminism. I feel it's something that really needs to be talked about. I've dealt with a lot of things where I felt, you know, that had some sort of feminism tied to it during my divorce and other things I have dealt with, and other men as well. So we have a lot of questions in the lines of feminism. What is feminism? What is the benefits of the feminist movement? I want to know, because I want to get highly educated on it, because when you don't have the proper education on something, you think the wrong way. And also we'll be discussing white privilege as well. Now, the guest I have for tonight is Ms. Erin Mattson and Ms. Alindra Letsam. They are both feminists. And we're going to discuss both of these topics with them tonight. So, as always, on the line, Ms. Gabriella, how you doing?
I'm fine.
Are you awake, Ms. Gabriella?
Do I sound tired?
All right. So, let's go ahead and get this started. We're going to bring in our guests, Ms. Erin Mattson and Ms. Alindra Letsam. Let me go ahead and bring them both in as we speak. How you doing, Erin?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on the show and participating in a topic that I really wanted to discuss. And Ms. Alindra Letsam, how you doing as well?
I am doing well. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank both of you for joining the show. And these 2 hours passed real quick. Trust me, it don't look like you've been on the show that long. So let's go ahead and just get started. In you guys' own words, no matter who want to answer, what is feminism to you?
Is that what you said, Alindra? Oh, wow.
Hey, I told you guys before the show started, it's going to be some questions coming your way, so get prepared.
Sure. Well, I'll answer first. That's fine, while Alindra gathers her thoughts. So feminism is simply a movement for equality and justice for all people. As a feminist, I ask those questions starting with women, but it goes beyond issues of gender. It includes race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, ability. Simply put, you can't have equality for some. There's no such thing.
Okay, so what you're saying, feminist movement is equality for all people, and that includes men?
It's not just women.
Yep.
It includes men. Okay. Now, Alindra, I want to ask you the same question. What is feminism to you?
Right. A lot of what Erin said I agree with, because Erin and I sort of were both, let's just say, indoctrinated in the same sort of feminist theories. But I will say the little bit of a pushback against the "and men" is feminism recognizes that in the American society and even globally that women are significantly disadvantaged. And so while we understand the purpose of male and like male allies and know what needs to happen, the other, or what good they can be in our movement, the real focus.
The real focus, you're breaking up, Alindra.
Oh, sorry about that. Sorry. Well, all I was saying was the real focus in feminism is on bringing women into equality with men. You know, like, male allies have a role, male allies have a purpose. We should never exclude anyone who wants to help. But at the same time, feminism really does focus on bringing women into equality because it recognizes the disadvantages that women historically have had.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, Erin said feminism is equality for all people. You said feminism is equality for all people. Most so we focus a little bit more on women because they're kind of, you know, disenfranchised or whatever. Now, let me ask you a question. what is, in your opinion, how is women either treated wrong, disenfranchised versus men?
Where do you want me to start?
Give me five points.
I can throw some things in there too. So this not even just in the U.S. So
any number of areas where women are disadvantaged. But let's start with some of the bigger ones. Just in the job market, women historically have and still unfortunately currently do make less than men on average. It doesn't matter your race, although race does come in later because then women of color make less than white women. But across the board, women make less than men. In terms of safety, there's this great story that's been passed along the internet over and over and over again about a police officer went to a college class and asked both the men and the women, what do they do for safety leaving the class? And the men had no theory about what it meant to leave a college classroom and worry about their safety. Women do. There are just, what are some, I'm sorry, those are the two. In the scientific field, and even just when you are in the job market as a whole, you are expected to perform at a different level, a sort of a higher level, higher expectation, not just higher expectations, higher expectations for essentially the same amount of respect in these fields. With our health, women's health decisions are second-guessed way more often than men's health decisions. I mean, and those are just the top four that I can just pull out, and as Gabriella said, she can pull some immediately. I'm sure Erin can jump in here too, but these are just some of the early, fast, hot-button areas where women are not treated equally, either as adults or even members in the society, and those are the sort of areas where feminism tries to address those inequalities and then promote change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Erin, and I would say, you know, one thing that we see consistently around the world, frankly throughout history, is that women and girls have always occupied a place that is less advantaged in society. Now, that doesn't mean it's the same everywhere. It doesn't even mean the way that women experience discrimination in the United States is the same from community to community. No, there are lots of variations. But if you look around the world, you know, you have, there's a recent Malala Yousafzai, the 16-year-old teenager in Pakistan who was advocating for the education of girls and was the target of an assassination attempt by the Taliban. So you have, you know, present-day examples around the world where it's different concerns, you know, just a simple right to have access to school, which isn't an issue here. But over here, you know, just as what Alendra was talking about, you have the issue of systemic and broad pay gaps in the United States. So there are just, there's a consistency of devaluation of women and girls and devaluation of our experiences, and also, you know, just an underrepresentation of women in leadership and overrepresentation of women in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So you feel that, listen, I'm agree with you on something. In the job market, it's been widely noted that women do not get paid the same amount as men. That's the truth, okay? But also in the job market, women are held to a certain standard that men aren't held to. I mean, that's, I'm just understanding that just from how I see things. For instance, like in the petrochemical industry, if a woman is an operator, she is, you know, held to the same standards as men to a point, but she isn't held to the same standard as men due to the fact of her gender. Now, if feminism is about equality, then why is it that traditional roles still set in about, oh, well, she can't really do that because she's a woman? And because to me, equality means you equal with men 100%. Now, is that what you're really trying to get to, 100% equality with men on every area?
I say yes. I actually say yes. And I would actually also bring up the early, like, 80s firefighter cases where they were like, women can't be firefighters because you need to pull XYZ pound of, like, a hose across this amount and women just don't have the upper body strength. None of that's true. Women can do everything that men can do. If the employer has made accommodations for a woman that are not related to the job performance, that's not what we're looking for. We are just looking for an equal playing field where if the job is I have to lift 10 pounds and a man has to lift 10 pounds, then we both have to lift 10 pounds. And that's feminism. And that's equality. Like, as long as though we're both evaluated on, you know, our ability to lift the 10 pounds or to stand for, you know, however long on a factory floor, without stereotyping or without trying to come up with some sort of, like, genderfication for my job or without paying me less. You know, I am one of the people, and I know there are many other feminists, who strongly believe that for every job out there, there is a woman whom it's her perfect job, and there is a man who it's his perfect job. And I do not believe that there are some things that women just can't do.
Well, I think this is Erin. I want to jump in because in the realm of employment, I think that, you know, there's a lot of research back up what Alendra said in scholarship and thought about how a lot of our expectations about what women can or cannot do is socially constructed, that, you know, for a long time they thought that it was dangerous for women to even participate in light sports, you know, and so that's been debunked, and so I think there's, you know, good reason for that. But I also want to bring up in the employment context, so just the other week I was participating in a lobby day for a bill called the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, which kind of gets directly at this issue of, you know, equality in some cases does mean accommodation for experiences that may be different from things, experiences that men are used to. So the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act would tighten up the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which is 35 years old. What that says is, hey, you can't fire a woman because she's pregnant. Unfortunately, the courts have interpreted parts of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act to mean that an employer doesn't have to give reasonable accommodation for pregnancy-related accommodations they might need at work. So an example of this, really, we're talking about things that make perfect sense for an employer to do, that it's not unreasonable. For example, if you work at a cash register and you need to get off your feet while you're pregnant, you should be able to have a stool and sit from that stool at the cash register. If you're doing heavy lifting, to have your duty shifted to a lighter lifting load during pregnancy, if your doctor says so, having access to having more bathroom breaks. So, you know, there are some things where true equality for women is and men is going to mean creating accommodation for women's experiences, and that's an example of it. But yes, there's a lot of things where it's just apples to apples. It can be totally the same thing. And then you also have to acknowledge that some things are going to be different and make sure that women are, you know, accommodated.
Okay. So, you know, yeah, I can agree with that. You know, if a woman's pregnant, you know, she do need some, you know, accommodations because that's, you know, that's a very special time. You know, you don't want to, you know, lose your child. I mean, I understand that. Some job fields, you know, wouldn't be good for pregnancy, in my opinion. You know, certainly maybe industrial work. You was talking about earlier firefighting. You know, I've, you know, been an industrial firefighter and alongside with women. And, yes, you know, really on a hose team, women can be on a hose team with men because you are all working together anyway. I never had an issue with it. You know, the women never had an issue with it. So I never get why somebody would say a woman couldn't be a firefighter. Unless they're going on the fact that she has to pull some big 250-pound guy out of a burning building. I guess that's what they're getting at when they say that. But that's, you know, here nor there. But this is the thing that, you know, I wanted to ask Alendra. Now, the thing is, historically, I can understand 100% Erin's position on feminism. And, you know, even Erin's blog. Erin, talk about your blog before I get into my point. The one you say that what only white men can do it. Well, how do you title it?
Oh, sure. So I have a Tumblr that I've started called White Guys Doing It by Themselves.
Okay.
And it's a pretty simple thing. It's white guys doing it by themselves, spelled all the way out, .tumblr.com. But what's up there is it's primarily things in politics and the media where you have a group of white men literally doing it by themselves. So, for example, today I posted two things. One was the Washington Post recently did a feature after the Virginia, I live in Virginia, the Virginia gubernatorial election, and they had five white men say what that election meant, which just is stunning because throughout the election, it was said that there's a heavy focus on women by both sides. And then, of course, the polling results after show that it was African-American voters who largely drove the McAuliffe victory. So it's just it's kind of blinding to consider why you only have five white men commenting on what this means when race and gender played such a huge role in the election. Another thing that I posted today was there was a piece up in Salon saying that the media is covering Obamacare all wrong. And it was, you know, what's interesting is this isn't just a conservative, you know, conservative people who do this. This is a liberal publication. It was a liberal commentator. He was a white man. And there was a picture of three white guys up at the top, and he name-checked 12 other white men political pundits in the article, and it kind of goes to show the whole purpose of this blog is to call attention to the fact that white men are largely running a lot of the most powerful things in our country by themselves. And it's the point of bringing it all together is to make it easy for people to see, because honestly this happens so much that for a lot of people it's kind of invisible unless it's laid out for you. And you can see over and over, you know, a group of white men talking about amongst themselves. I'll just give one last example, and then you can go to the question. I actually started this because I just got tired of yelling at my TV. And it's so frustrating. And it was actually right after the shooting, there was another mass shooting. I believe this was the one at Navy Yard, which is in Washington, very close to where I live. And, of course, you have Piers Morgan is on CNN, and it was just so brazen. There was a panel of four white men on TV, and it said America's battle over guns. And it's like, is America all white men, 100%? Why are we only hearing from white men on guns and frankly, everything else? And so the whole purpose is to cast light on that dominance that has become almost invisible because it's so routine.
So basically what you're saying is that America still operates on white male supremacy.
Yes.
Okay, and we talk about this a lot, and a lot of times as black people, we shut down, oh, that really doesn't exist, what are you guys talking about, but yet it's in our face 24/7, and you're acknowledging it, and I thought it was cool that you were actually acknowledging it. Are people like, you know, yourself, Tim Wise is another person that acknowledges this sort of thing. You know, you familiar with Tim Wise?
I am familiar with, not too much, but lightly.
Okay, well, look, if you research into him, he talks about some of the same things you're talking about, you know, like the white privilege, white male-dominated society, how they don't, you know, really want, you know, people of color, all this other stuff. The same thing is kind of like what you're talking about if you research into him. He's hated a lot, you know. And did you get some backlash about your Tumblr?
Well, I get a fair amount of the trolling where, you know, people call me a racist bitch. I apologize for swearing.
Oh, no, yeah, on this show you can say,
I get it all the time.
You say what you want on my show. I'm letting you know. You say what you want. But how can you be called a racist?
They say I'm sexist.
Well, let me ask you a question. How are you a racist?
They say I'm sexist.
How are you a racist talking about your own people? So how are you racist?
Well, what they're saying is that it's just somehow racist or sexist to point out that white men are largely in control all by themselves. And I really disagree with that. I've written a post about it that I've actually linked out to on the Tumblr. But, you know, to put it very succinctly, in a hypothetical world, maybe it could be considered racist to point out that white people have it better. In a hypothetical world, maybe maybe it can be considered sexist to consider that men have power that women do not. But we do not live in a hypothetical world. Look around you. And the fact is that we live in a world where white men have the most dominance in society. And so to say that, you know, this is somehow an attack on white men is not accurate. You know, I'm married to a white man. You know, white men are part of my life, of course. But the fact mm-hmm. is that you know, there's an unearned privilege that's bestowed on white men in specific who have so much dominance, and it's really unfair and unjust for people of color, women of color, and women, whether they're white women or women of color.
Okay. Now, I got a question for Alindra, but I see a caller on the line, so I'm going to see if I can let him in and see if they got a question for you before I get to Alindra, because I have some questions for her. Area code 334, you on the show. Area code 334? Well, I guess they just listening. Okay. Alindra, now, I got to ask you a question. You being a black woman, how you doing? All right. This is my question for you. Now, I understand historically why Erin and, you know, women like herself being white women really needed feminism, because historically, you know, their man kept, you know, their foot on their neck. They couldn't do nothing. They couldn't even vote for a long time. They could have no say-so in the house other than just have some babies and do, you know, what he say. Now, Erin, isn't that correct historically?
I think... I'll let you keep going with Alindra. That's fine.
Okay, no, I'm asking you before I continue.
Well,
is that correct?
We can have a long discussion, because I think, you know, the fact is that white women are not monolithic either. And so, you know, it's class also comes largely into play. And women have different experiences within race as well as between race, is what I would say.
Okay. Now, Alindra, this is the thing. Historically, you know, from when we got here to America, our ancestors, up until now, we, you know, have never been in a position of power, correct?
In
the United States, I would say yes. In the United States. I'm not talking about in back in the day. No, I'm talking about the United States. We don't control the banking system. We don't control the job markets. We don't really control power. I mean, Obama, yes, he's one person, but he doesn't really control anything. You know what I'm saying? So with that said, you know, I'm gonna speak from the area of how a lot of black men feel in the area when they hear a black woman say she's a feminist. Some black men feel like, well, they're being betrayed because we suffer together. A black man has never held down black women from getting jobs. You know, we suffered everything, you know, that had happened to us together. It's not like black men got a pass and then black women was treated a certain way, or black men get paid, you know, a whole lot of money versus, you know, black women. I mean, yes, that does factor in. Women do get paid less, but in the area of people of color, let's say, you know, black men, black women. So let me ask you a question. Why do you feel as a black woman you should have joined the feminist movement when really black men has never held down black women for anything, like to hurt their quality of life?
Oh, wow. This is trite, but if I had a dollar for every time I got asked that question, I would be richer than Bill Gates. This is such a common misconception, a common misinterpretation of what feminism is and what it isn't, and how it plays into social justice as a whole. Feminism, being a feminist, does not therefore mean you are not a civil rights activist, and they can go hand in hand. The reason that I'm a feminist and a civil rights activist, you can roll it all into social change, I don't really care what you call it, is because I know that you believe the history that you've been told, but actually black men did gain advantage before black women. And, you know, if you even look back...
They got
back
the right to vote before, so, you know.
What would you say, Ms. Gabrielle?
Black men had the right to vote before black women, so it's not
Exactly. So they gained that advantage well before black women. If you look back in the civil rights movement, there's lots of testimony on how the black women in the civil rights movement were treated. We weren't equal. We weren't there on the stage at the I Have, I mean, we were there at the stage at the I Have a Dream speech, but a lot of us didn't speak. You know, like, we were in the back rooms. We were feeding. We were housing. You know, like, there's a lot of interracial, I don't want to use the term oppression, but interracial differences. And then there's the other, I'm sorry, all of that is to say that that's why I support the civil rights movement. I support all of the social change that is still going on in the civil rights movement. But I'm also going to support a movement that takes into account my gender, because there are things that even the civil rights movement doesn't yet have a handle on. You know, the issues that are very woman-specific. And so, therefore, I take what I can and I do what I can in both the feminist movement and the civil rights movement and the social change movement I'm a part of, and all in this idea of a rising tide will lift all boats. In other words, if you can get to me as a black woman of color who is a feminist and a civil rights activist, you can probably get to, you know, a good percentage of other people. And if you can get me to closer to equality, I can raise other people too. But the other thing I do want to point out, because I don't want to fall into this trap and this is unfair, I am a black woman. I am not every woman of color. I am not even every black woman. You know, like, I come from a very specific background and a very specific socioeconomic class. I cannot possibly speak for every black woman's experience. There are some black women who are not going to find any use in the feminist movement. They're not going to find it useful. They're actually possibly going to find it harmful. I get that. I understand that. I've seen it play out, unfortunately, all that being said. But for me, personally, I find that I can be good in the feminist movement, and the feminist movement can be good for me, and the civil rights movement can be good for me, and I can be good for the civil rights movement. But to my black brothers who are afraid of black feminists, I would honestly say, buck the hell up. You know, like, these are the women you want.
Well, hold on. What did you just say?
Buck up.
What?
Be buck up.
No. I don't want. Okay. Buck up in the area of what? I mean, like, because a lot of these brothers that feel have an issue with at least the black feminists. Like, a lot of times, and this is an issue in the black community, they want to run the household. They want to tell you what to do and have you like a little boy in the house.
Okay,
I wouldn't call that feminism. That's just being
being a bit of a pain.
And
right,
you know. That's not even treating your husband as your equal. That's trying to sit there. Like, if you're yelling at somebody, slapping them around, and mistreating him, that's not – I wouldn't call that feminism.
And it's not feminism.
Well, a lot of men equate all that to – I'm just saying how men equate a lot of that stuff. You know what I'm saying? I'm coming from
the
male perspective.
And that's actually one of the things where that actually crosses back across the color lines, in that I worry that white men equate the same thing with feminists. They equate feminists as shrews or people who yell and, you know, want to be able, you know, want their husband to be subservient. None of that is feminism. You know, real feminists don't hate men. You know, like, as I said before, we need male allies. We know this. All we are asking for is equality in society. And so, like, it's not saying that we hate you or want you all to be lesser and us to be higher. You know, we just want equality. We want fair treatment, fair representation on account of gender. Add on to that, for me personally, civil rights context, I would love more diversity across the way. And then you've got a pretty good America. That's all we're asking for. Unfortunately, there's just this misconception, I'm going to call it out, that's been spread by, you know, the right wing and the misogynists and the women haters, who say that if you are a feminist, you are this shrewish, terrible witch of a person who just, you know, essentially wants to keep men's testicles in a jar on your nightstand. That's not feminism.
And Alindra, this is why I wanted to have this show, so I can get it out. What is feminism? That's why I asked you at the beginning, what is feminism to you? Get it all out, that we have no misconceptions. Because I have a lot of areas I want to question you and Aaron on that's very, very important, and how, you know, people look at it as society as a whole, or even men, and look at things, because you keep speaking about equality, But some of the areas I want to go in, there isn't really no true equality. It's actually more one-sided toward the woman and not equal between the woman and the man. But let me see. I got a caller. Let me see if they want to ask you a question. Caller, you got the 111 area code. You on the show?
Yeah, hi. This is Mr. Solution. I was listening to what the lady just said, and just say, if I can just use the word nonsense, that's exactly what.
What lady? What lady? Give me a second. What lady are you talking about?
The lady who spoke last.
Oh, Alindra.
The lady who spoke last? Yes, it's what she did, and I thought you would check her on this, but she talked about being part of the feminist movement. Because women didn't get the right to vote until after men. And I think she was thinking about black men. But who did that? That wasn't black men. And the other thing is, everything that she claims legitimate, how is that different for being treated racially juxtaposed to your citing gender? Do you follow that question?
Okay. Well, give me a second. Alindra, you want to answer that?
Sure. I thank you very much for your I wasn't trying to imply that I hate black men. I do not hate black men. And you're right. There's a lot of interaction and interplay between race and gender. But there are some things that are just gender specific, such as, I mean, I hate to go back to this, but I will because this is one of the easiest things to pull, women still make less than men across the board. That's understood. That means black women still make less than black men. If we deal with the economy and just raise wages for, you know, all men, black women still aren't there. You know, like, you have to raise the wages for women. And unfortunately, the civil rights organizations aren't working on the wage gap as a gender issue.
Let me respond to that, if I may, because I think you are sadly mistaken about that. CONSAD research, which was commissioned under the Department of Labor to study that the so-called gender wage gap extensively, and they found that it was the choices that women make. Women generally take off more from work than men do. Women usually work less overtime than men do. And also, women work less dangerous and dirty jobs than men do. So you can't just take an average when you're not looking at equal things. When women do the same work that men do, they do get paid equal for it. But I want to throw a couple more at you. For example, the military. Women are not required to register for the Selective Service. Now, that is a burden put on every adult male upon reaching 18 when no females have to deal with that. And males can't get jobs. They can't get professional jobs if they don't register for the Selective Service, nor can they get Pell Grants or loans, student loans. And I bet you didn't know that. They have to register for the Selective Service. You all don't have to do that.
It's the law.
Moreover, you all have all the reproductive rights.
I'm gonna get into reproductive rights in the next section because I have a lot to say about reproductive rights. But let her answer about the Selective Service. Now, Alindra, Aaron, do you feel that due to feminism and true equality, as you state that feminism is about, do you feel women should have to register for the Selective Service?
This is Aaron. I feel pretty strongly that the military should be all volunteer in the United States. However, if we are going to have registration, it makes sense to have everyone have to do it.
Okay, everyone. So is the feminist movement pushing the American government to do that the women should be registered for the Selective Service? Is that one of the active things that feminism is pushing?
We have way bigger fish to fry than that.
Excuse me?
And I would say that the women's movement is, of course, you know, my personal beliefs or Alindra's personal beliefs, we are feminists, okay? There are multiple kinds of feminism and versions of that. And so, you know, we don't represent the entire movement and we don't have control over that, over what the entire movement does. But I can say that, you know, military issues are something that that feminists have worked on for a long time to ensure equality in the military. I mean, it was only in the last, few years that women were finally allowed onto submarines. It was thought that that was somehow bad.
Or even into active duty.
Into active duty, yeah. So there's all sorts of discrimination still within the military. I'll let you finish with that, Alindra. But the fact is that, you know, a lot of feminists will say something similar to what I just did, which is, you know, that the preference is for the military to be all volunteer, period, but we should be treating people equally under the law, and it's unfair to have one group singled out and not the other.
Right. And exactly what Erin's saying, I mean, with regard to the military, there are a lot more, I think, pressing issues that feminists are concerned about rather than draft possibilities for women. I mean, women are being, unfortunately, consistently sexually assaulted in the military. They're not being drafted for active duty or even, not drafted, picked for active duty, which means they don't get the pay bump that goes with active duty. They get pulled into active duty anyway, but they don't get any of the benefits that men who are listed as part of active duty get. I mean, there's a whole
I don't agree with that, because my sister-in-law, she was a Marine, and she is inactive, and she gets all her benefits, the same benefits that my brother-in-law gets that is currently active in the Marine. So how is it that she don't get the same benefits he gets?
She does, because she went through the Marines. Like, it is so rare, and I'm sure your sister-in-law will tell you, it is so rare that you find women in active duty. And it is so rare when you look at the entire population of who is in the armed services. If you look at the entire population of who is in the armed services and it was fair or it was equal that people were raised into active duty, the numbers wouldn't look the way they do. And so that is those are the bigger fish that we're frying. We're not there. We have so many problems in this country with gender, just gender, not even race.
May I just jump in again? Part of that problem migrates from our social interaction. And there's a great book on this subject by Dr. Warren Farrell. It's called The Myth of Male Power. One of the things you all don't do, you will so-called fight for special rights, but you don't ask for dates. Generally, you don't pay on first dates. You don't initiate initial contact with men, what I call introductory contact. All of this plays into how the genders perceive themselves. And one of the reasons that there are so many problems in the military, they recently, by the way, lifted the ban on ground combat for women.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. But one of the reasons there are so many problems is because women play this independent, dependent game. They want to be both independent and dependent simultaneously, and I submit to you that that's schizophrenic. What has to happen is you have to be a whole person. You have to do the same things that men do because you have the same rights that men have. And I would encourage you to look up that study. It was done by CONSAD Research. Women are not paid less. Women are paid less because women don't do the same jobs. They're not paid less out of discrimination. Now, let me give you the quick argument because I'm a business person. If women did the same work as men, and labor is one of the most expensive aspects of work, why would anyone hire men when they could get women for a 15, 20, 25% discount? Could you answer that?
Because they don't respect women.
I don't think you're answering my question. If you could choose a workforce and get women who would work for 25% less than men, why would it even be an issue as to whom you would choose?
Are you going to let me answer the question now instead of talking over me?
Yeah, he asked you the question, so Alindra, go ahead and answer it.
All right. I cannot speak as an employer because I am not an employer, but what I have seen in the workforce and have been reported from women and even have experienced myself is women are the cheaper labor force, but when they want someone that can be respected, when they want someone that can be trusted, when the managers want someone they get along with, they want a man. They have to go through different hoops, different thought processes to get to the point where they trust a woman, and that always disadvantages the woman, whether it be she needs a secondary degree above the basic degree and education requirements for the job, whether she needs more tenure before they start to trust a woman. I can, you know, in terms of why businesses do what they do, there's a lot of questions I would love to ask businesses, but I know from my experience and from my research and from my studies that they hire women because they're cheaper, they hire men because they trust them.
Well, Alindra,
well,
not to cut you off. Hold on, brother. Alindra, not to cut you off, but my company that I work for, a woman is a CEO.
Congratulations.
So she's running the whole thing. So what I'm saying is if the shareholders didn't trust her, she wouldn't be in that position. I mean, what he's saying, I mean, I get what he's saying. Let's talk about my industry. There's a lot of women that work in the petrochemical industry, and they pay them the exact amount of dollars they'll pay a man coming in the door. They would not pay a woman, you know, let's say $20 an hour and pay the man, you know, $32 an hour. I mean, everybody gets the same pay. If she got the same process operator technology degree as a man, she's going to get the same amount of money, same benefits, everything.
Okay.
In certain fields, yeah, you don't see a lot of women in it. I'm seeing more and more women coming in certain fields. Yes, I'm seeing that more and more.
Right.
But if you're going on the fact that she's a secretary versus – you got this guy who's maybe a major player. Let's say I'm going to keep talking about my industry, in the petrochemical industry. They say maybe he's a supervisor, maybe he's an engineer or stuff like that. Or, prime example, I know a neighbor. She's an engineer, live right by me, and she makes the same thing as any man would make.
Okay,
so
I'm going to that with two things. One is the problem that we run into with something that you had sort of brought up earlier, which is when we pick these one-off examples, everybody can go, well, Obama's president, so we don't have a race issue. And we all know that's not true. When we have one or two or 15 women CEOs, that doesn't mean we don't have a gender issue in the workforce. And what I'm also going to say about women making it the same as men, and I wish this was ancient history, but it's not. The Lilly Ledbetter case was recent. You know, the Lilly Ledbetter case, she was an employee at Goodyear. I just want to make sure I'm not saying anything that shouldn't be defamed. She was an employee at Goodyear. Maybe when she started, she was making the same, but she was passed over for promotions over and over and over again until the point where she, and then, of course, she never knew it because they kept their salaries quiet. So she thought she was making the same as other male managers, younger male managers, newer male managers. And it wasn't until somebody gave her a list, secretly passed her a list of the salaries, that she saw the gap in her salary between her and her male counterparts or even lesser experienced male managers. And that was, I want to say, like 2005, 2008. That was recent. We're still talking about women are passed over for promotions. Women aren't coming in at the same pay grade. Women routinely miss out at those upper-level jobs. And you can't just look at one or two examples and say that as a country we've solved it. We really haven't when consistently women get passed over.
But I wanted to ask about that case.
Are women. And I'll make this point very briefly, but to really look at the numbers, yes, we do have some women in top leadership positions. But when 4% of the Fortune 500 CEOs are women, and you have women outnumbering men in the pursuit of degrees these days, you can't say that it's about interest. It's simply, you know, it's a mismatch, it's misbalanced, and so there still is a problem that needs to be corrected. We simply aren't tapping into the full potential of everyone, and you know, I think frankly that feminism and all equality movements, whether it's feminism, whether it's the civil rights movement, whether it's the LGBT rights movement, the more people we include, the better off we are as a society.
And if
okay.
I can go just
okay.
Highlight.
Well, I don't want to make this, like, I don't want everything to get too heated. I kind of wanted to turn this more, like, I wanted to discuss something more positive, such as I'm really passionate about women's rights worldwide. I do understand that there is a lot of things that happen in this country, such as I don't even want to go into rape because Women are victims of rape all the time, and in this country, it's glossed over like it's nothing. Rapists get to walk the streets. You get a slap on the wrist, go to prison for 4 years, and get to just run around and do whatever they want, and it's okay. But my thing is that I want to know what the feminist movement is doing for women who don't have it as easy as women do in America, like women that get their noses and ears cut off because they may have committed adultery, or women that get, that get their clitorises cut off because they don't want the women to enjoy sex because they feel that that's going to cause them to become a loose woman, or the fact that like little girls in foreign countries won't get the opportunity to go to school and they get sold into prostitution because they feel that, because their parents feel that they're just a liability. That's the kind of, for me, that's what, in terms of the feminist movement or just human rights in general, that's what I wanted to know more about.
Erin, you want to take it?
Sure, I'm happy to take it. I mean, I think that, you know, the women's movement exists around the world, and it plays out differently in different cultures. We've been talking a lot about U.S.-specific issues because that's really where I know I spend most of my time, and Alendra, I believe that's true as well. But, you know, you see, the thing is that we don't all have the same experiences, and so this idea of, you know, it's not necessarily that feminism is something that is an export to other places. Feminism takes its own incarnations in other places. Recently, there was the Saudi Women Drive Day that you may have heard about, where women in Saudi Arabia who are not allowed to drive by themselves, some did drive by themselves in protest. And, you know, recently the ban has been lifted on women riding bicycles at all. They still have to ride them in special places, so designated for it. But the fact is that around the world you have women who are working to better their conditions in which they find themselves. And these movements around the world are linked.
Yeah, I would agree with Erin. I mean, feminism in the way that we are talking about it, has a very American flavor because it grew out of the American scenarios. The feminism that you are seeing around the world, the sort of activism, the sort of uprising, if you can even call it that, just even just sort of the acknowledgement of the inequalities, those have to, and they are, growing organically, and that's really the way that they need to grow. I think in the past, when some feminist groups have tried to work on international issues, they've come in with a little bit of a white savior complex, and that doesn't help. You know, the issues need to, and the solutions need to come from within the communities, and then, of course, what the American feminists can do is support those women. But again, that's easy enough to make an analogy towards even American feminism. When it's breaking out of its traditional communities and trying to go into other communities, traditional feminism really, of course, needs to listen to what the communities need and want and where they are finding problems and grow
okay.
from there.
Ms. Gabriella.
Mm-hmm. Did everybody get dropped off the call? Or?
Yeah, I don't know what happened with her call. I don't know. Lindra, like I said, I don't know what happened to your call.
I'm here.
I'm here, too. This is Erin. Hey.
I don't know. I think they got dropped.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I think this is Mr. Solution. This study I was telling you guys about, it's called CONSAD Research and the Department of Labor. And I really would encourage you to get that because that's one of the most extensive studies that has been done on the so-called an analysis of the reasons for the disparity in wages between men and women. And I'm quoting a Professor June O'Neill here, and she's written extensively about how time out of the workplace or years spent working part-time can reduce future pay.
And likewise, this lady, she's an economist, Diane Futchgott-Roth. I'm pretty sure you guys have heard of her. From 2000 to 2005, she was over the Department of Labor. And what she points out is that the decisions that women are more likely to make, to choose flexibility, a friendly workplace environment, and other non-monetary factors as compared to men. So what they concluded, and I read the entire report, is that it's not discrimination against women, it's the choices that women tend to make. And that Ledbetter situation that you mentioned, that was rectified.
Okay, Alindra, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay.
Okay, we both got dropped from the
yeah,
call.
We got. Boy, I'm glad y'all kept going. Y'all good people, because I didn't hear. Boy, we got dropped for a minute.
Could I just clarify one thing? I just want to answer the previous caller on one more thing.
Sure.
He mentioned that our situation got rectified. Actually, it never got rectified for Lily. It never got rectified for Lily Ledbetter. She actually never received her back pay. And she actually never received the fines because the Supreme Court cut it down. So it did not get rectified for her. It got
right, but I mean for future women, ma'am, because I understand. I think the deadline, the timeline was she was past the expiration date. But it did – I wish you would portray it properly. It did rectify situations like that for future events. But that was exactly what you were pointing out earlier. That was a – very small example. We're looking at the macro, and the macro example is what the CONSAD Research Department found out, is that it's not discrimination that is causing the pay gap. It is the choices that women choose.
Well, okay.
There's no way that we're going to have any agreement on this. I think that,
I want to step in.
That women are to blame for any disparities in the workforce. And that's just simply not something that comports with the data that I've seen, nor does that reflect my beliefs.
But we could agree
on
this.
Hold on, brother, because we're going to have to move on to a different topic. I can't just keep riding jobs because I want to get to reproductive rights. That's one thing I really want to talk about. Yeah, but just hold on a second. So, Aaron, Alindra, reproductive rights. This is something that's very dear to me. What is your position on reproductive rights in the area of abortion? Now, I know you heard recently Texas had passed a very strict abortion law, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, basically, it would almost close almost all abortion clinics, minus maybe two or three here in Texas. They really spearheaded that. I know you heard about the lady who was, what was her name, Wendy, what was her last name?
Davis.
Okay, Wendy Davis that was trying to filibuster that and to stop that from happening, but Governor Perry ended up getting it passed. So didn't it go again to a higher court and they had tried to hold it off or struck it down or something like that, if I'm not mistaken?
My understanding was it didn't go. It got fined in, like, the dark of night, and then it got challenged. And I'll be honest, I have not followed it since then.
Okay.
The
court, now, this is the thing.
The court cases are still pending. I can say, now, I have not been covering this issue, but for a pretty comprehensive overview, RH reality check, we have on-the-ground reporters in Texas who've been tracking not just the passage of the bill, but also the court development. So that's something that people can follow up on. But we can go into your questions.
Okay, let me get to reproductive rights. Okay, reproductive rights, in your opinion, in the area of women is what? Because I have some questions about that in the area of unborn children, in the area of fathers as well. So what do you feel is reproductive rights in the area of feminism and women's rights to choose and all this other stuff? I want to hear your personal opinion to it, because I have some real life stories about, you know, how certain fathers feel about this.
All right, I'm going to do this first because Aaron's going to take up all of this, I know. Reproductive rights, short, it's the woman's choice. There. Now,
okay,
Aaron.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty quick summary. Reproductive rights and reproductive justice is something that is absolutely intertwined with feminism and justice for women. There is nothing that is more affecting than a pregnancy when you talk about physically, the physical changes that come with pregnancy, emotionally, spiritually, financially. It's so deeply personal and all-consuming, and that's just something that the state has no business interfering with. And this is, you know, when you talk about having children, what a personal thing. And so the state really has no business making those decisions for individuals either in terms of prohibiting access to abortion or, for that matter, the one-child policy in China is an example on the flip side where that's deeply unjust to have the state interfering with people's personal choices and decisions and lives. I want to talk a little bit about reproductive justice as opposed to simply reproductive rights. Reproductive rights is what we often talk about in terms of, you know, do you have access not just to abortion but also family planning, medically accurate sex education, a whole annual well woman visits, access to information about STDs, and the like. Reproductive justice takes that a step further, and it's not simply about choices and about health, but it's also about justice. And so how do we make sure that everyone who wants to have children can raise their children in healthy families, healthy communities, have access to appropriate health care? It's a much broader thing than simply abortion, which is often what reproductive rights and justice are boiled down to.
Now, everything you stated about health care, everybody would be for that. Education, everybody would be for that. Proper access to health facilities if something's wrong with the woman and or her baby. Everybody supports that. I don't think no human being would not support that. But let me tell you a story. I had a man I used to work with, and he had a girlfriend. They was together. She got pregnant. And she was discussing with him that she really didn't want a baby at that particular time, not because something was wrong with the baby or the doctor said, you know, well, I think you should probably terminate the pregnancy due to health reasons. No, she just didn't want a baby. He said, well, this is what I'll do. You know, I'm a hardworking man. I want the child. He said, just have the baby. You can sign up with parental rights, and that's it. Like, it's no harm, no foul. She said, no, I'm just going to terminate the pregnancy. And he said, but why? Why would you do that? He said, this will be my child. I don't have no children. And she ended up doing it anyway. And this guy was almost crying in my face to feel like this woman did this to his own child. And this man didn't have no children at all. Now, in the areas of that, when you hear stories like that from men who just wanted to have a child, wanted to be a father, men have no rights at all to their unborn children. Now, do you think that is right?
Well, I think it's always very sad to hear stories about relationships where a couple is not on the same page. And that extends not just to abortion decisions, but, you know, when a couple, when one person in the couple really wants to try to have children, there's no pregnancy even. And that's really sad to hear about because it is so deeply personal. That said, I think that, you know, in those instances, these stories that you hear, a single story does not necessarily make good policy. And when we talk about in the realm of public policy and legal access to abortion, that's something that we need to make sure that women are able to access themselves. And so,
Aaron, you talked about it, but you didn't answer my question. Do you feel men should have some sort of reproductive rights to their unborn children?
Well, I think that you know, when you're talking about pregnancy, I think that under the eyes of the law, that it's appropriate to have women who have the ability to make decisions for themselves. And I think that for a variety of reasons.
That's one issue, Aaron. That's one issue, like, just me as a father. Like, you know, if I was put in the same position as this man, you know, that would tear me apart to know that this woman is just going to do this to my child. I mean, just because it's not convenient for her right now. And that's what I don't understand. See, a lot of men have an issue with that. Like, women have a lot of outs with children. They can have abortions. They can give them up for adoption. Nobody's going to say anything. They're going to not charge you child support. They can do a lot of things. But men, we have no really reproductive rights on our unborn children. We have no outs at all. We can't say, hey, I don't want to be a father, and walk away, and the state don't say nothing to us. Now, that area right there for me isn't equal. It's actually women have all the power when it comes to children, and men are looked at as lowly, you know, creatures. And I feel okay, go ahead, Alindra.
This is Aaron. Just one thing I'd like to say really briefly, and because this is all so fresh, I am a new mom myself. I have a 5-month-old daughter. She is the light of my life. I still very much remember the process of pregnancy and childbirth. And in specific, when I was recently delivering my daughter and in the hospital, I think I was struck, as someone who's worked on reproductive rights for a long time, I was struck by how amazingly personal this experience was, and how, you know, I was surrounded by other women in severe pain. Not they want to be in that pain. They want to have kids, including me too. But the fact is that we really need to, and it's the right thing to do, to respect women in their capacity as making decisions about bearing children themselves. And it is such a life-altering, in some cases life-threatening condition to be pregnant, that we really need to make sure that from a bodily integrity perspective, that women are able to make sure that they can have whatever health care they need.
I would like to comment on that also.
Okay, well, what's your comment, brother? Because I'm going to get to another call. What's your comment?
My comment is we should not value women's bodies more than men. If a man is forced to work to pay for a child that he didn't want, that's his body being devalued. Now, women were created to bear children, so that's not a curse, as it were. But I think there has to be some legal balancing here so that men have rights in reproduction just as women do. And I think you, as the host, you said it well. And I'll just amplify, men have no legal rights, and women don't care about that. And one of the reasons is that men have not talked to women sufficiently enough as adults to help them understand life is not all about them. We have to share this planet. We have to share this particular reality, reproduction. And it's not just all about you. It wasn't that way, say, 50 years ago, and it shouldn't be that way 50 years going forward. Men should have some say. They should not be forced into parenthood. And just as the host said, you guys have a plethora of options when you get pregnant. You can, first of all, you have the best birth control. You could avoid pregnancy altogether. You can give it up for adoption. You can choose to keep it. You just have this smorgasbord of options. But yet when we talk about having a Roe versus Wade for men, all of a sudden your body becomes sacrosanct. And I would say to you, that's not mature, nor is it fair.
Okay. All right. Well, Aaron or Alindra, do you want to answer that question before I get to the next caller? Hello?
Alindra, did you want to weigh in on that?
This guy makes my blood boil. No.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, why is he making your blood boil? Alindra, hold on, Alindra. Why is he making your blood boil?
Wow, this is going to get personal. Because he reminds me of the unfortunately very scholarly but uneducated men that I have had to deal with. In other words, he's willing to use societal constructs that are gender biased to explain economic choices. He's willing to use biblical constructs that, and I as a Christian am wildly offended, to, you know, explain gender differences or gender norms or even gender roles. And all of that cannot be used in the same context when you're talking about feminism as a social movement, which is trying to change American sort of society and our justice system. Our justice system should exclude all of that. It should not matter what the Bible said you were supposed to do or what society said you were supposed to do. The justice system is supposed to look at you as an individual with equal rights in this country. Therefore, when it comes to reproductive issues or when it comes to jobs, not to go back onto jobs because I know you want to go away from
no, I want to stick to reproductive rights because for me, I'm a father. And like I said, that's his opinion. My opinion was more so on just facts based on being a father and based what's on the table. I'm not going to talk about the Bible and anything else. I'm talking about just facts. And one thing, the facts are there. There are 30-plus forms of birth control for women. Women can give a child up for adoption. Women can have an abortion and all that other stuff. And the state would not hold them accountable for anything. As men, you can't say, hey, I don't want to be a father. The state says it doesn't matter. You're going to pay this child support for 18 years. And if you don't pay this child support, you will be locked up. Your license will be taken away from you and everything else. So men don't have an option at all. They can't even if you try to sign over your parental rights, the state was in a lot of states to still make you financially responsible for that child. This is what we talk about, the big difference in men versus women in the area of children and reproductive rights. And on top of that, we can't even tell a woman legally, say, listen, you cannot abort that child. I want that child. We can't even do that. I can understand if something was medically necessary, like, okay, the doctor's saying, medically necessary, you may lose your life, or something medically necessary to terminate the pregnancy. We're not talking about that. We're talking about like a story where I'm talking about a woman saying, you know, I just don't want a kid right now. It's not convenient for me, like using abortion as a form of birth control. And okay. A man who wanted the child, who doesn't even have children, who want to be a father and everything to this child, a hardworking man, not a bum, not a thug. We're talking about a hardworking man who can provide great insurance and a good life for this child. You know, that man doesn't have any rights. And this is what we're talking about, because at the beginning of the state show, you say feminism is about equality for all. So this is one area that I would like to see equality for all.
Okay, but you're even starting from a flawed premise. Men have birth control too. So
yes, they do. I quote you the birth control: abstinence, vasectomy, and condoms. That's it. We don't trust me. Men want a birth control pill. They begging for it. They really do.
And I've actually been told there's one that is going through FDA testing right now. But those are their options. And I want to echo what Aaron said. While this is heartbreaking and while there are a few stories like this that creep up every now and then, these are very personal conversations that really need to occur between a man and a woman. But always, at the end, I am going to go with respecting and trusting the woman's decision.
Brother, hold on. So basically,
well, call me Mr. Solution, but I want to speak to that too.
Well, hold on, because like I said, this is the thing. So basically, what you're saying, Alindra, like, even though I presented everything, you know, like I said, I didn't go from the Bible, I didn't go from nothing else, just facts that what we have in American society and with law. You basically said that, yeah, I get it, and that's heartbreaking, and you know, it's very personal, but I still side with the current system where men doesn't have any rights at all. That's your position.
Okay. I hate to parse this out, but no, I'm not going to agree that I'm saying that men don't have any rights with regard to a fetus. I'm not going to call it an unborn child. It is a fetus. What I am going to say is, in that scenario, the onus is on the woman, therefore the decision is with the woman.
I get that currently, but according to the beginning of the show, feminism is about equality for all, even though, yes, you want to fight for women's rights, and I get that. I understand that. I have no issue with that. I really don't. I'm just talking about children, something that's very sensitive to men and women. I'm not, you know what I'm saying? I trust you. I stated before, if it's something medically necessary or even a rape or something like that, incest, whatever, I'm not saying a word. But I'm talking about stories like this, and these stories aren't just far and few in between that I'm talking about. there are many men who tell a lot of these particular stories and who are decent, you know, decent men. They're not bums. They're not criminals or rapists who rape the woman or, you know, whatever. These are the men that I'm speaking about. So, I mean, you stayed your position on that. There's other things that, you know, I also wanted to talk about as well in the area of feminism and true equality. But they got another call on the line. I want to let them in real quick. Erica, well, I guess you're on the show. If it says unmuted, it just all, it says all ones. How you doing? I guess they're saying all ones. They don't give me an area code. Oh, well, I guess they're not going to say anything. Okay, Aaron, before I go to the next topic, do you have anything else to add to that about reproductive rights? Do you feel the same way maybe Lindra feels about it, or you have a different position on it since you're a mom?
Well, I think something else I'd like to bring into this discussion is that we've had, you know, this isn't, we don't live in a country where women have, you know, a ton of reproductive rights. In fact, consistently over the past few years, there's been record-breaking numbers of restrictions on women's reproductive rights adopted at the state level with the help of conservative money that has been pouring in post Citizens United and with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that's also behind the Stand Your Ground gun laws, has also been pushing these laws to restrict women's access to reproductive rights, whether that's pushing restrictions on abortion rights, whether that's restricting access to birth control, whether that's restricting access to family planning. I think that's an area, you know, where you and I might have some common ground, perhaps, maybe not. But based on what I've heard you say so far, it doesn't sound like there's necessarily an objection to having public funding to help for family planning, access to birth control that couples can use. So I think, you know, the issue is that women don't have it so great in this area, and reproductive self-determination is something that we're still striving to achieve. But I can also say, you know, as a new mom, that you know, the perspective people ask me all the time, as someone who works on reproductive rights, if having a baby, if being pregnant, if having a baby, if having a daughter, which is what I had.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I love it. Has changed my position about abortion. And I get that question a lot. And I can honestly say that the experience of pregnancy, the experience of having a baby, and the experience of physically delivering a baby, as well as the experience of having a daughter, has made me more pro-choice than I ever was before, simply because I now have a very personal and recent awareness of how all-encompassing pregnancy is, of how intense and strenuous and demanding childbirth is. And now that I have a daughter, also a sense of protectiveness and wanting to make sure that no law puts her in danger someday.
Okay, Ms. Gabriella, you got anything to add to this?
I mean, I don't really know what else there could be to add. I mean, I pretty much, because I have a hard time with this one, because I don't even want to get into my own personal stories and things like that, but God, like, it's so hard to explain my stance on things like that, but because my thing is, like, every situation is different, and yet, I don't feel that it is right for a man to not have any say at all when it comes to a child. But then it's easy for a man to say, oh, well, I'll just have, you know, you can sign over the papers and give me the child. It sounds simple for the man, but for a woman to have to go through the throwing up in the morning and having your feet swollen and having your teeth fall out and gaining weight and having watching your body change for 9 months, and then like having, and sometimes you may have to take off of work, and that might end up affecting your career. And what is your family going to think? What are your friends going to think? I mean, there's so many things that come along with pregnancy from a woman's standpoint that it's really difficult to say, oh, well, you know, men should have equal rights with a pregnancy, because they don't have to go through the same things that a woman has to go through. They just don't. And if you were a mother and you had to be separated from your, like, let's say if I was in that situation and I decided to, okay, I'm going to go through the whole 9 months, have my baby, and sign over the papers, I'm not going to be able to hold my child at night. And I know that my child is out there somewhere, but I'm not going to be able to really be a part of their life.
But you know the difference is between that and let's say abortion, you can always go find that child. That's the difference.
Yeah, but what kind of damage is that going to cause to the child psychologically? Because I don't want to get into my own personal stories too much, but if you were in a situation where you knew that you had a parent out there and your parent didn't really want to have anything to do with you, that's going to cause a lot of psychological damage for the child, because they're going to feel like, well, why didn't my mom want me?
Well, that's a lot of kids, believe it or not, Ms. Gabriella, go through that daily. I mean, how many times we hear about that in the black community? You know, one parent have them, they leave, they don't come to the dad, or sometimes even the mom don't show up in their life. I've met many people that had deadbeat dads and deadbeat moms.
I had a deadbeat dad, so I know how it feels. But deadbeat moms exist too. So it's so hard to say, oh, well, just like both, you know, both of our guests said, that it's so difficult to pass legislation that's going to benefit one person rather than passing something that's going to benefit everyone as a whole. I do feel that men should have some sort of say, but at the same time, they don't have to go through. It's just not the same. Like, a man can't really.
But my statement, Ms. Gabriella, was if a doctor deems it medically necessary or something, that's totally different. I'm just talking about.
Yes, I understand.
It's not convenient for me today. So this is what I'm going to do. I mean, that's just my opinion. But because we got 42 minutes, I want to move on to the next topic we're going to talk about. Go ahead.
Can I just say one thing about that? And this is going to be troublesome, I know, but I just really feel the need to say this. I think in those scenarios where the man feels that the woman is just making an arbitrary decision, I would ask the man to analyze who he's dating, who he's in a relationship with. I mean, that's the scenario we're talking about. We're not talking about one-night stands. We're talking about these two were in a relationship that didn't need state interference at all, and then all of a sudden he doesn't like a decision that she is going to make, and he wants to invoke the state. That's a healthy relationship has a conversation. A healthy relationship, both parties hopefully can see the good in it, even if they're still heartbroken over it. You know, I know this is going to be troublesome, and I'm almost certain there's going to be trolls.
No, nobody's going to troll you, Alindra. You could open up a can of worms and you say the state, because you can go by that logic, then women get the state involved all the time on men. Child support, they quick to do that. So,
well,
you know.
Well, has determined that they have a vested interest in children. But like at the point where the woman is deciding again whether she's going to keep or terminate the pregnancy, a woman who is in a relationship.
And Linda, when you go on a date with a woman, you don't sit at the table with her and say, "Oh, okay, you know, let me ask you a question. You have a kid. You're gonna get an abortion." So you're basically saying we need to ask that on first date.
Not on the
first. I'm not gonna ask that question. Okay, the second date, the fifth date.
That is something that you should ask before you start having sex with somebody. I think that's the question.
I don't want to be Miss Manners about it, but, like, yeah, before you start having sex with a person, you should know what page they're on. And if you don't, I'm not saying that it's your fault or I'm not saying that a man just gives up the right to have.
Yeah, because Alindra, no man knows like how women think. Like if we all knew how women think, it would be no trust me, life would be a lot better for us. But we don't know. I mean, like no man thinks that way about, oh well, if I have a child, this woman, she's gonna, you know, have an abortion. I mean, we just don't think that way, you know. But you said to ask. So I'm going to make sure to let men know that as I do my video commentaries when it comes up. Ask a woman if she's willing to have an abortion for any reason. That way it's on the table. And I'm glad you brought that up. Now, that's
and I say that you should ask that before you start having sex with somebody or even before you even enter a serious relationship or anything that's going to involve sex. You need to know. I mean, there's a lot of questions you need to ask.
Exactly.
And not to get too off topic. Not to get too off topic, but I've seen couples get married and one partner wanted kids, one partner didn't. That's something you should have asked months ago or years ago or however. You should have asked that very early on. You would have saved yourself a lot of trouble. Same thing with abortion. If you are pro-life, then, and this is something that you feel very strongly about, then I feel that it's your responsibility as a man to ask the woman how she feels about it, so that if that situation does come up and you're not comfortable with your, if you know you're not going to be comfortable with your child being aborted, you can save yourself a whole lot of hassle.
Well, yeah, well, see, the problem with that is the woman doesn't have to ask. She has a default defense. And what I'm hearing from feminists is a lot of entitlement, privilege, and narcissism.
Well, this is Erin, and I'm just going to back this up a little bit because I don't think it's any of those things. What I think the issue is that, again, when we're talking about regulation of reproductive rights, we're asking a question, who is best equipped to decide whether or not a specific person should have a child, that individual or the state? And always, the correct answer is with the individual. And so really, you know, to back up on a few things that were said recently. So I do think that, you know, this idea that both Alindra and Gabrielle are talking about, that we have, that having better communication in relationships is always a great thing, right, up front, and that, you know, people should be having difficult discussions up front. That said, a lot of women who have abortions, that's not a procedure that you plan to get usually. And so things come up, health needs can change over time. And so what a time when a pregnancy could be really welcome, you know, a woman could be very welcome to a pregnancy at one point in her life, and at another point in her life, it's really not something that she can do. And so that's something that, again, you want to make sure that from a legal perspective that women are in a place where their lives are not in danger because of restrictions on them. Earlier today, about this issue of men, because I think one of the issues that we're kind of skirting around here is whether or not a woman should need permission is probably not quite the word, but should need to have authorization to have an abortion from a male partner who is that. I'm sensing that may be an issue. And I'm just thinking earlier today, and this may seem a bit off the beaten path, but it's not. Earlier today, I was doing the drive-through ATM, and, you know, I've got my new little daughter in the car, and she's crying because we're not driving, and she prefers to drive. Those of you who have kids know that kids like to move in the car. And I was starting to get a little ticked. I'm like, what is taking this person forever to go through the ATM? And then I realized I was looking forward that the woman in front of me in this car had this gigantic black eye. And it was one of those things where I looked at it and just went, oh, my gosh, you know. And then at that moment, I actually said out loud in my car, I'm like, take all the time you need, honey. Like, take all the time you need. And we know that domestic violence is something that is very common, and whether it's – and it's often not talked about. Interestingly, I've had the same woman.
Oh, Erin, you opened
up
another can of worms, Erin.
Oh, yeah. But just to close this one up, and then we can talk about that, because I think violence is a really important issue to be talking about. This
I fear that any well-intentioned, I don't think people have bad intentions necessarily, but any well-intentioned, even a well-intentioned effort to require men to sign off on abortion, say, could have just disastrous effects and put some women in real danger.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think
because you wouldn't, like, how would you, I mean, I don't mean to cut you off, but
yeah.
If, let's say, for example, if a woman, I mean, there's been plenty of cases where I've seen women that were left with 5 children, and I mean, they had no job, no education, and no money, and they were left to just figure it out. And so let's say, for example, if women didn't have the right, like women had to get permission from the man that they slept with to sign off, like to be there, to sign off a paper, I mean, I wouldn't even want to imagine what would happen if, let's say, a woman, like there's plenty of situations where a woman would have, maybe she had gotten pregnant from one night stand. How would she... So she couldn't have an, so basically she wouldn't be able to have an abortion because she doesn't know who the father is, or she is not able to get a hold of him, or what if he just says, I don't want to be involved.
But what
anyway.
About birth control? Why do we go from 0 to 100?
I mean, I understand. I don't even want to get into that. I feel, my thing is that they have birth control or the morning after pill in
yes.
Walgreens. So it's not
Plan
like
B.
It's not like you can't prevent a pregnancy. I always feel that it would be better to prevent a pregnancy rather than to terminate it. But there are times when birth control.
I agree with
safe.
That. I agree with
so,
that.
I mean, I'm actually my standpoint is more of I am a strong supporter of education, and I feel that birth control really needs to be more accessible. And it is in some places, but there are places like, let's say, the Midwest, where young girls, it's almost a cultural norm to be pregnant in high school. So, and to go and to want to go to the pharmacy and pick up some birth control pills, you'll get more flack for going and doing that rather than getting pregnant and having a baby. So.
Really?
Yeah,
with
you do.
It ties in with comprehensive sex education. It ties in with access. It ties in with so many things. It ties in, as you're saying, with, like, socioeconomic status. Like, where I am, I'm really close to D.C. So I live in a fairly urban, fairly affluent community. I can, you know, get to a CVS or a Rite Aid or a Walgreens fairly easily. That's not true for all women. And, you know, also, I can, when I get to that Rite Aid, pay for a Plan B fairly easily. That's also not true for all women. And then the third part is, I know that Plan B exists. Also not true for all women. And so because of all of those disadvantages, the state can't come in and decide that someone who is not going to be bearing this child can have or should not, I think the state should not come in and give any sort of influence or authority to a person that is not bearing this child, that the person bearing the child, who is right now biologically still a woman, has not given that person.
But aren't we told all the time that women are smarter than men? Where does that play a role here?
I don't think it has any effect on it whatsoever.
We actually weren't.
Really?
Let's not get into that.
That's also an opinion. I'm gonna stick to facts on that.
Yeah,
and because that's not. All, I mean, obviously, we see that's not true on both genders. Who's smart and who's not, personally. But anyway, let me move to the next topic. I want to talk. I did a video a while back, okay, and it had a lot of the comments on it, and I said men have become anti-marriage due to feminism. Now, do you understand why I did that video?
I do not.
I did that video because when men go to court, when let's say a relationship fails, a man finds out real quick that he is nothing in the eyes of family law courts. That a man could come into a marriage with it basically working hard with a business, whatever he's doing, and let's say the lady could come into the situation and she could take half of everything that's his. She'll get the children without even being the man being considered. For to be the custodial parent, he has to pay spousal support. Sometimes in some states like California, you've married 10 years or more, it may be almost a lifetime until they get remarried. And a lot of men are feeling that it's no advantage at all for them to get married under current laws because they feel they're very feminist in nature. They're not true equal laws. Because I'm going to give you my example. When I went through a divorce, okay, I was shocked at how the way the law works. Now, technically, if we want to look at my income at that time versus her income, I was the more financially sound parent. I was always in my children's life. I have no criminal record. I have never put a hand on my, you know, ex-wife or anything, or no woman at all. So there's no reason to say, well, this guy isn't a fit parent. I was with my children from the day they was born up until that time period. Now, you know, she was only making a little over $30,000 a year. I'm making $70,000+ a year. So let me ask you a question. Why isn't the court would consider, okay, he is more financially stable? Maybe let's think about giving him possibly or giving him the opportunity to say, hey, do you want, you know, full joint custody as be the custodial parent? Now, in court, it's always the woman can make less money. She can be making no money, and the courts would still give the woman the child right off the bat, no matter how well the man is doing in courts. I mean, it's done time and time again on that. A lot of things, you know, when men are just seeing that happens to them, they just say, you know what, forget being married because I'm going to get, you know, creamed in court. Don't even talk about how ungodly child support can be and how they look at your children as just fine, you know, money and not look at them as human beings. And the children suffer so much with these court systems where their fathers can't be in their lives. And that's not good for the children. I'm thinking about the essence of the children. Now, what is your take on some of these laws? Because a lot of men have gotten to the point that they just done with the situation, and a lot of women are single due to that.
I don't know if this came up in my bio or your conversation with Aaron, but I'm actually a lawyer. So okay. I can actually tell you for a fact that actually the maternal preference wasn't always the way. It actually, children used to go with the man because the man would make more. The maternal preference is a fairly new decision, and now actually there's not even a maternal preference. They really just go with who, or the judge is supposed to make the decision upon who is the best interest of the child, and a judge is supposed to try and weigh as many possibilities for joint custody as possible. Now, I can't speak, of course, to your specific instance because I wasn't there and I wasn't your representative and I wasn't her representative, but in a courtroom that's working, the judge is supposed to try and keep things as sound and stable for the child as possible, and if they believe joint custody will work, that is going to be the decision they go with. If, for whatever reason, a judge, a learned lawyer, decides it's not going to work, they will decide which parent is the better custodial parent. And also, just to add a little credence to this, I actually represented a father who was trying to gain custody back. Visitation back from his ex-wife. So I am not unaware of what happens in family law. But much like actually abortion, family law specifically, unlike almost any other portion of law, is so very issue-specific, case-specific, and unbelievably personal. You know, the judges have a hard job that they have to decide upon, and then they have to try and work out what's going to work out best. And what unfortunately happens, does happen, is the judge will make a decision in, say, year one. By year five, the parents have oftentimes gotten over the animosity of the divorce and have come to the amicable resolution that they couldn't come to in year one. But because they went in front of the court and said, separate us, the court had to step in at year one, when really the court would have loved to have gotten them in year five, when they're over all of their animosity and their hate for each other and their just willingness to just let the other person go. And so the judge and the family law courts have to deal with that couple at the year one of their divorce. The other thing I'm going to say about men being over marriage is I would be over marriage too if I was in marriage to get divorced. People don't get married to get divorced.
Nobody, like, no man. I'm going to tell you about most men. Most men, when they get married, they're not saying, oh, I'm looking to divorce this woman. Most men don't think like that. And actually, statistically, 75% of the divorces that's filed are by women, not by men.
I mean,
women are doing most of the filing, not men. So we don't come into the situation saying, oh, I'm looking to get a divorce.
And if I may say so, the reason they are doing the filing is because they know the courts are biased toward them. And they'll get the kids. They'll get the bank account. And it's more than 50%, by the way. Now, I haven't been injured personally, but I work with men's groups and in the court. So the women know that there's a financial gain in filing a divorce. That's why so many of them do it. And we need to have these conversations so that women particularly can understand some of the positions that men have. And I would say that a man's body having to work and sacrifice for 18-plus years is far more consequential than a woman carrying a baby for 9 months. And I don't know why we want to see the woman's situation as so torturous where it's not the same with the man. That's a bias and a privilege and a situation that's going to have to be addressed.
All right, brother, give me a second. I got a caller coming in that I wanted to see if we get him on my area code 281. You on the show?
Hey, how you doing? I'm just listening in.
Okay, just listening. Okay. Now this is the thing I wanted to say about the situation. Like, I'm gonna go back to me because I can just relate to how my situation was. You know, you got a guy before a judge that's making 70+ thousand a year, full benefits on his children, never been, you know, always took care of his kids, had his kids in the house, neighborhood, nice neighborhood, no drug infested, no none of that, you know, homeowner association, just good stuff. And you want to, you know, take the children from him, and they want to give her the house when she clearly says she could not afford the house. And now, from a judge's standpoint, why would you take those children out of a home that the mother's going to lose? And she did lose the house. She did go into foreclosure because she could not afford it, but she didn't want me to have the house because she just being evil. Why would you do that? But yet the judge would go along with that, because if I was a judge, it would be no way I'd go along with that. I'm like, you know what? You know, if you want the children, sir, and you can take care of them, I'll give you the children because you have a home for them. You have everything set up for them. They have their school. They have their friends, everything. Mm-hmm. Why would you want to rip them from that environment to go some apartment somewhere and wherever that apartment may be at that she can afford versus their father who's making decent money, having in a good neighborhood, good environment? I mean, that doesn't make a bit of sense.
It doesn't make any sense, but as it has been repeated several times, it's case-based. And maybe, I mean, I don't want to get too personal, but you may not agree with what happened in your situation, but the judge felt that what their decision was correct.
But it doesn't make, like, logically, it doesn't make sense. And
it doesn't make any sense.
It goes back to what we were saying earlier, that most of these, you know, decisions are made based on, you know, the women. And they don't have it equal. I mean, if you think about the best interest of the children, well, who can provide the best lifestyle for the children? That's how I think. Who can provide the best lifestyle?
The feminists have a gun to the cowardly judge's head. That's the reason they do that. The judges are wimps.
Well, let Aaron and Alindra answer that. I mean, what I'm saying. I mean, because I'm talking from a father's perspective, a father who loves his children. That's what I'm talking. I'm not talking from just fighting over, you know, who's right and who's wrong. I'm just talking about the children, because I've seen what the children have been through, the psychological things, the heartache they've been through. I mean, I'm very concerned and involved parent. That's where I come from.
Yeah, all of us pay for it as citizens, though.
Well, hold on, brother. You know, Aaron or Linda, you get where I'm coming from?
I do, and I'm going to reiterate, divorce is hard, and it is not the end result when you all got married. And I think the state, involving the state, which the law now does by, you know, making you go in front of the courts, means that a third person, you know, has to come in and make a decision. And there's no way I can possibly retry your case on the phone like this. You know, and I understand that you are upset about the way things happen, but you sort of reiterated some of my points when you were sort of mentioning the behavior of your ex-wife. You had used a phrase like she was being evil. That's year one divorce animosity.
Well, I'm sorry. Hold on. I'm sorry. But most men know that you don't know a woman until she get upset and how she – if I knew she was like that, I would never even talk to her 2 seconds. So she was never like – she got like that during a divorce, especially when these divorce lawyers gas their head up and say, you can get this, you can get that. And then they, all of a sudden you see them in court and they totally on something different. When you see them, most men can tell you that. Like, they may have a conversation with her before court and say, well, we'll work this out, work that out. Then the divorce lawyer – that's why I say divorce lawyers, a lot of them – like, oh, man, I just can't stand to see him because you – I mean, that's a sensitive time of family, you know, going that route. And
yes.
For to, you know, have one thinking you can get this and you can get that, and it's not even about that.
The judge is – I mean, in those situations, what the judge is really trying to do, not the client's lawyer, not the – but what the judge is really trying to do is provide the – best, most stable environment for the kid. But, I mean, I don't know all of the things that the judge went through, but I'm going to disagree that it always goes with the woman. It doesn't. It has a tendency, unfortunately, because society has based women to believe they are much more caregivers or much more maternal, which some women naturally are, but not all women. And some men are natural caregivers, but not all men. But because women have bought into the role of caregivers or have embraced their roles as caregivers, then usually in relationships they are the predominant caregivers. And so the judge is going to try and put the children with a caregiver. Again, though, this is all year one.
So basically what you're saying, a lot of judges have gender bias.
No, they are looking
for... That's basically what you said. I mean, think about everything. You're saying the judges, I'm not talking the women, I'm saying basically what you're saying, the judges are having more of a gender bias.
I am never going to say that about my lawyer colleagues. They are looking for
I didn't say your lawyer colleagues, I said the judges. I mean, just if you listen to everything you just said, you said that the judges tend more to give them to the women. You stated that in so many words. So basically the judges have more of a gender bias.
And no,
which
I
is a lawyer.
Evident. It's evident in court, in a lot of the courtroom decisions that, you know, men talk about. That happens with their children. Like I said, I'm not talking about men who are bums and who are deadbeats. They don't deserve to kid.
I'm not either, and I'm not talking about that either, and I can't believe I'm going to admit this on this radio show. I am actually a child of divorce, and my parents are both very well educated. They did very well for themselves. When my parents split, the judges looked at who provides the most care. Now, granted, both of my parents are very well educated. My mother is a lawyer. My dad is a scientist. Right? Both well-educated, both have good jobs. They looked at who provides more caregiving, and they decided it was my mom, right? So I'm not, and I really want to be clear, I am not saying that judges always give to the mother. I am saying they give, or they are going to try their best in the hour or so that they have you to figure out who is the caregiver. And that's who they're going to want to give the children primary custody to.
Because I'm just saying, because most of the time, Alindra, with men, you got to prove, I mean, this woman is just horrible. I mean, you have some concrete evidence that she's horrible with your lawyer for you to even get a chance to get your children. I mean, versus it's not.
Totally disagree on that. If the two parties can show the judge that they can be amicable, at least in front of the children, the judge is probably going to go with joint. And so it is not to one parent's advantage over the other. It's when the parents start showing that they can't be amicable, that their animosity for each other is going over into how they care for their children, that the judge has to make a decision. And to actually use a biblical term, they kind of have to split the baby. They have to make a Solomon-like decision, one way or the other. They can't do both because the parents aren't presenting themselves in a scenario where they seem like they could be amicable or equal caregivers or equal decision makers for the children. So the judge has a very limited amount of time, a very limited set of information, and they have to make a decision.
Okay, now, Aaron, do you have any opinion thinking about this?
Well, I'm not a lawyer like Alindra, nor do I have expertise in family law like Alindra. So I think, you know, this isn't something where I'm necessarily well-equipped to speak to this at length. I'm sorry hearing the details of this, that you had a nasty divorce and that you And I'm really sorry to hear that, and I think that that's, you know, that's really heartbreaking to hear, and certainly no one likes that. I think that in particular some of the statements the caller has made about feminism is wrecking it for fathers, that's, I don't agree that that's the case, and that's not, you know, ignoring that you've had a bad experience and that some other men have had a bad experience, but I don't think that the judges are biased against men. I mean, actually, if you want to talk about judicial bias, we have a recent case where a child was raped and you had a judge. In fact, this child had been raped by her teacher in Montana. And the judge had said at the time of sentencing that he was just going to give the guy 30 days because the girl had somehow brought on the behavior herself. At that point, the girl had already committed suicide, and her mother had to scream out in the courtroom, "You all suck." I mean, so you have, and there was another case recently about someone who was raped at a very young age and a really short sentence. And so, again, I think that, you know, there's things to look at all over the place in the judicial system, but to say that the judiciary is something that's, you know, overwhelmingly biased toward women is not something that I agree with.
Okay, Aaron, give me a second because I want this person to keep trying to get in. Let me see if they want to ask a question. Area code 623, you're on the show.
Oh. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good.
Got any questions for the ladies on the show?
No, I don't have any questions.
Okay. All right, you're just listening. No, so let me get to about 13 minutes left in the show, and I want to get to something that is going to be mostly directed to Aaron. Aaron, the statement you typed on Twitter that you have more of an advantage being a white lady in America, having white privilege, explain what does that mean and how does that relate to other races of people?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think at that point I've been talking about, you know, since it's only been fairly recently that I started doing this, white guys doing it by themselves, Tumblr. And in the course of that, obviously, you know, the fact that you have white male dominance in society brings up a lot of issues of both racism and sexism. And I think that, you know, had been talking in context about how I don't believe that racism and sexism are the same by any means. And I acknowledge that though I am a woman and I experience sexism, that I also, of course, against my own wishes, but still white privilege impacts my life and has given me unfair advantages, you know, throughout my life. And I think that, you know, white privilege, you can either call it white privilege or racism. The fact is that racism, just like sexism, impacts all of our lives, no matter who we are. And it's a question of what opportunities you have and how readily accepted you are in certain contexts. So I have no discomfort at all with, you know, sharing the fact that white privilege has affected my life as much as it has affected somebody's life who is not white.
Okay. Now, so when people, let's say, of minorities talk about this, you know, why is it that a lot of white people just get angry? I mean, you could be discussing it amongst, you know, a crowd of black people. They hear it and they just get, no, that's not true. But when we look at the job market, who do we mostly see holding all the major positions? Yes, they white males. I agree with that. But they have some white women, you know, not as many. who, you know, when you go into the bank, who you see the branch managers, who you see running everything, who you see on Wall Street, who you see in the government. I mean, this country has so many, you know, different groups of people, you know, Arabs, you know, blacks, Hispanics, you know, Native Americans, all these different people that we have in this country that lives here, the melting pot. We don't see the melting pot of diversity in things like that matter, judges, police officers. I mean, you can't tell me that all these different groups of people aren't being lawyers or they're not being police officers or aren't being in government. You can't tell me that because that wouldn't even be true.
Well, I mean, they are, so you can't say that they're not, but it's just not as much. And minorities don't get a fair shake in America. I really don't want to veer too far off topic, but let's just, I wanted to share a personal story about my stepfather who immigrated from Africa, and he had the hardest time getting a job. Now, mind you, he has a PhD from Cambridge University in Britain. And for the longest time, the only job he could get was stocking shelves at a grocery store. And it wasn't because he was not able to do the work. It was just because he had an accent. And, it's not like he couldn't understand them, but, you know, minorities don't really get a fair shake in America. So that's just how it is, unfortunately.
Now, Aaron, let me ask you a question, and this is something I always said. Do you feel that white people is the one that can eradicate racism and no one else?
No. I think that racism is something that it belongs to everyone. It's something that we need to
work
on.
Do you get the position where I'm coming from on that and why I say that?
Did I understand you correctly in the way I answered that? Do you feel like I understood the question?
Let me reword it. If you say about white privilege, let's say if, you know, the majority of white people say, you know what, we're sick of this. Everywhere we go, it's not equal, and we're going to push more equality, and we're not going to put up with racist attitudes or nothing. Anybody's like that, we're going to expose them, get rid of them, because this is not what we want anymore as a society. Now, if white people do that as a whole, do you feel, for the most part, that racism will really go away, not completely, but for the most part, it won't be the social norm that is in America?
I think two answers to that. One, I think that white people have a responsibility to acknowledge racism and to work to undo it. Yes, I think that that's something that all white people and all people should do. So I think that's important. I think that, you know, at the same time, so often discussions about racism focus, as well as sexism, it's a very similar thing, focus on, is this individual, do they have bad views about other people of a different race or of a different sex? When individual views are certainly very important and something that needs to be examined and something that, you know, you need to ask questions about and work to eradicate discriminatory beliefs in individuals. But racism, just like sexism, is institutional. And so simply changing minds is not going to solve the problem all by itself. And we have got to change laws. I am a strong proponent of affirmative action, both in terms of race as well as gender. I believe that until we take proactive steps to make changes, that simply beliefs alone are not going to solve the problem completely. And so while beliefs are very important, we also need to proactively look at changing laws. And that's far-reaching. Mm-hmm. Even things that appear to be race or gender, for that matter, gender blind in their application are often not. So you want to talk about laws? Stand Your Ground law is a great example of a law that doesn't explicitly mention race or gender, but you look at what happened to George Zimmerman, arrested again today, by the way.
Yes, he was.
And compare that to
domestic violence and pulling out a gun on a pregnant girlfriend.
Yeah, and so you look at the, that's a perfect example of a law that's supposedly completely race and gender neutral, right? But we have to take a look at where impact is going. And so yeah, just to respond to your answer, in your question in two parts, I think, one, that white people along with all people have a duty to acknowledge that racism exists and to work to change the situation, but also that simply having beliefs that say, hey, no more discrimination, that's not acceptable, is not going to get us out of this completely, and that we have got to look at changing institutional level policies and laws and aggressively working to level the playing field.
I can definitely agree with that. So we're coming up on 5 minutes left on the show. Alindra, let me ask you a question. You practice law in D.C.?
Right outside, Maryland.
Maryland, okay. I didn't even know you was a lawyer. That's awesome. That's great to hear. You're doing it big, sister. I'd like to hear that.
I'm glad.
I say, Aaron, you work at a PR firm, a magazine, or what do you work? Something like that, an editor, something like that.
I work in my work life, and I want to be clear that the blog that we've mentioned a couple times is something that I do personally on my spare time, just to stop me from yelling at the TV. I just started putting it on the internet instead of photos, but for my job, I am an editor-at-large with RH Reality Check. We do reproductive and sexual rights and justice news analysis and commentary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That sounds good. So both of you are career women. You're doing your thing. And, I mean, now, do you feel you equally paid for your job?
I can speak to that. I think I have a little bit of a different experience than Aaron does. I have always worked in nonprofits, mostly women-focused, women-based nonprofits. So they made, of course, an affirmative decision so that to pay on a scale that was comparable and based on job requirements. So I, thank heaven, have never... I've never worked in a place where my gender wasn't an issue, but where my gender did become an issue, not in pay scale, but in respect and seniority, is I'm also a scientist. My undergraduate degree was in biology. There is a lot of discrimination and barriers and just different experiences that women have versus men in the scientific fields and in the science education fields that I did experience. And so, and that actually was one of the things that sort of pushed me out of science and into law, was that I didn't feel as supported, as resourced, as really supported when I was studying the sciences. And so I just turned my analytical mind towards the law.
Are you trying to change a lot of these laws that's affecting, because you stated, yes, sexism is real. I agree with that. They do have sexism out there. And also, you know, with you being a black woman, you already know the walk that, you know, black women walk in this nation. You already know that. I mean, you know, let's keep it real. We know.
it's a very sharp edge that we have to walk. We're either the mammy or the sister girl, or we're Michelle Obama, or we're Beyonce, and all of those are individual people. None of those are every black woman, and it's a very difficult. It can be a very difficult experience to be a black woman in the United States. I totally get that, but I would definitely say that there are things that are just me being black. There are things that are just me being a woman. And then there are experiences that I get by being a black woman. And I, because of that, I try to analyze where is the best place to correct those experiences that I'm having. And feminism sometimes helps. Civil rights movement otherwise helps. Sometimes just being a loudmouth helps too. So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I want to definitely thank everybody for joining the show tonight. We are almost about at the end. I want to thank Ms. Erin Mattson for gracing us with her presence, and Ms. Alindra Letsam also for gracing us with her presence. I see, didn't I tell y'all at the beginning of the show there's going to be some conversation going back and forth? Were you ready for it? Didn't I tell you that at the beginning?
You did.
Hi. Okay, all right.
You weren't kidding.
All right, so don't hate me. Don't hate me because I love everybody. I'm just passionate about something as well as you are passionate about it. And but like the other brother said, we need to have these discussions and bring this stuff to the table that way we can know how each other think and see if we can come to a consensus on some things that's, you know, good for everybody, not just one group versus the other group. That's just how I feel. You know, I think we could all work things out. We all got to live together in this country. We all got to, you know, support each other the best way we can. And, you know, by getting our differences of opinion out about different things, that's just, I think, the best route to go. I don't think no one group is evil than the other. I just think that we just should work together. But I want to appreciate everybody for joining the show. We'll let you guys know about the show for next week. And I want to thank my guests, thank all everybody listening on Ustream and on Blog Talk Radio as well. So have a good week, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.